Welcome to Division 2 of the Court of Appeals. We have two cases set on the 130 docket. The first case is People versus Hagos. Am I pronouncing that correctly? Hagos. Council President ready, it looks like. All right, we'll take that case first. Second case is People versus Martinez. Council President ready in that case. All right, very well. We'll take that case second. I'm sure all of you have argued here before. Let me briefly review the ground rules for those who have not. Our first case today is set for 20 minutes aside. Second case today is set for 15 minutes aside. You'll be guided by a lighting system at the podium, which works basically as follows. When your time commences, the green light comes on. When 15 minutes have expired for the 20-minute argument, and when 10 minutes have expired for the other argument, the amber light will come on, signaling you have 5 minutes left, and then the red light will come on when your argument must conclude. We would ask you to stay at the podium, please, because we're recording your arguments. We find it helpful to go back and listen to them occasionally, and if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up well. Also be aware that your arguments are available over the internet within a few days following today. So if there's anything of a confidential nature you do not wish to disclose, be guided accordingly. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you've set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to your legal argument instead of reciting facts, that's fine with us. At the same time, however, the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask that anybody in the audience that has a cell phone or a pager, please ensure it's turned off at this time. And with that, we're ready for argument.
May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Ripucci, attorney registration number 30069, appearing on behalf of Mr. Abraham Hagos, the appellant in this matter. Obviously, the issues in this appeal are numerous and complex. I've briefed them extensively. Our time today is obviously limited. I do appreciate the extra 5 minutes from the court, but I do not anticipate being able to cover every issue. And quite frankly, I probably can't explain them anymore with any more exactitude than I have in the briefs. I do want to answer the court's questions as fully as I can with regard to any issue, but at the beginning, I'd like to focus the court on the two clearest errors below. The first was the admission of the shooter's confession without the opportunity for cross-examination. And the second issue I'd like to address is the disqualification of the public defender's office, which was Mr. Hagos' counsel of choice. If it pleases the court, I'll start with Prim's confession. There's no question that the shooter's confession to police, introduction of that at trial, violated the Confrontation Clause under Crawford. The Attorney General's office has essentially conceded as much. So the real question here is whether or not this error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. That is, this court must apply constitutional harmless error analysis to this issue because it's fully preserved and Crawford applies retroactively. This is the prosecution's burden to prove harmlessness beyond a reasonable doubt. This court must assume the damaging potential of the confession was fully realized. This is not an analysis of whether the guilty verdict would have been rendered in a trial without the error. It's an analysis of what effect this error had on this trial. If there's a reasonable possibility, a reasonable probability that this error contributed to the verdict, then it cannot be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Applying this standard to this case, I submit that it would be completely impossible for this court to conclude that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And to reach that conclusion, this court, frankly, need look no further than how the prosecution prominently featured the confession in its opening, its closing, and its rebuttal. The prosecution urged the jury repeatedly to rely on this piece of evidence to corroborate all of the circumstantial evidence in this case. And this was a case that was based almost entirely on circumstantial evidence.
Mr. Rappucci, there were other people who testified to things Prim had said to them, were there not?
There were, Your Honor.
And weren't those essentially the same facts, admission that Prim had killed an individual and had essentially emptied the clip of his entire gun into the car?
They were not essentially the same facts. You are correct in the way you've articulated them. They're far less complete than the confession. And with regard to the November 4th attempted murder, which is three of the five substantive charges in this case, the only evidence from Prim and other statements was that he'd fired his gun two times. So we don't have, the confession is far more detailed than any of those statements. And Your Honor, so to that extent, I think where Your Honor's going with that is that aren't these statements simply cumulative as the Attorney General's office argues? And they aren't simply cumulative, because what they do is they're used by the jury, or the prosecution calculates them for the use by the jury, to tie together all of the rest of the corroboration. And so what these statements are able to do is bolster and add to otherwise suspect credibility of virtually all the witnesses in this case, that is Kosal So, Trey Money, Matt Connor, all of whom were testifying for self-preservation, quite frankly, and for leniency. So to the extent that they are slightly cumulative, that's only one factor in the analysis. This court also has to look at the importance of the statement to the prosecution's case. Obviously, if it wasn't so important, they wouldn't have been bringing it up over and over and over again, and there wouldn't have been all the numerous pretrial hearings. With regard to corroborating evidence, there really is no independent corroborating evidence. No one was present at the scene but for Prim at the shooting scene. Kosal So had dropped him off. He was not an eyewitness. At the attempted murder scene, Matt Connor was there, and the other evidence from that scene came from Jimmy Roberts, the victim's statements, which also raised Confrontation Clause issues, which I'd prefer not to address at the moment.
Well, what about Mr. Connor's statements? Didn't they, to some significant degree, parallel the challenge statements we're talking about?
Well, they certainly didn't parallel with regard to identity, because Mr. Connor didn't know the identity of the shooters. They didn't parallel it. I suppose they did, because Jimmy Roberts had said that the shooters had shot first, whereas apparently Prim's confession, and this is found nowhere else from Prim, in his confession he indicates that I lost my train of thought, Your Honor. If I could back up again. The Matt Connor and Jimmy Roberts statements do paint a piece of the picture, but Prim's statement completes it. And what it does, and even if you look at those factors, what Prim's statement does is it makes those statements from Mr. Connor and Mr. So, who again wasn't present at either scene, but Mr. Connor and Jimmy Roberts, it makes those statements more trustworthy because it corroborates them. So right there, it's playing an effect in this trial, and it's contributing to the verdict. So this court can't simply dismiss these statements as cumulative.
And if we agree with you, counsel, can we still affirm on the first incident, the attempted murder? Because Prim's statement was really, I killed someone. But how did it affect the attempted murder? He didn't commit the attempted murder.
Well, Your Honor, I think Your Honor may have a misunderstanding of the facts.
Okay.
According to his confession, he was the shooter. He was the shooter at both.
He went out for the first one.
The first.
That's when the horns were not honked.
Correct.
The car horns. And Prim tried to kill him
Prim's confession says that he was the shooter, one of the shooters. The other shooter was a guy by the nickname of Lay, who, you know, from the hearsay testimony, it seems his gun jammed up at the scene.
Okay.
But Prim was, in fact, a shooter at both of the scene and the sole shooter At the murder.
Okay, thanks for pointing that out. I wasn't clear that Prim was at the first one. Now, Judge Bayless said, well, I'm letting it in because Prim doesn't implicate the defendant. Do you want to comment on that? Or did I get that?
Well, that's correct. And Judge, I would comment on that. The analysis that Judge Bayless was following was the analysis of the Colorado Supreme Court 2001 case of Stevens, which has since been declared to be an unreasonable application of governing federal law in Stevens v. Ortiz, which was the federal habeas case. So the question is really not the reliability of his statement. It is the fact that this statement was being used to implicate Mr. Hagos. And so it was a testimonial statement, and it was used by the state as material and direct evidence of Mr. Hagos' involvement, and perhaps the most material and direct, or certainly it was, in fact, the evidence that enabled the prosecution to tie together this otherwise circumstantial case. And if this court were to go back and say, well, without this piece of evidence, they might still have convicted him, that would be the improper analysis. That's not constitutional harmless error analysis. And that can't, this court can't employ that analysis.
Just to follow up on this, was it cumulative? Because I think that's what we're going to hear from your opponent. They've got the testimony of So, who said, I was sent out, I was hired by defendant, paid money to get somebody to kill Jimmy, and that's what I did. And then, of course, we know that Jimmy was killed. You have the two things, the statements of Jimmy. It's true that Prim connects the dots by saying I was the shooter, but she's going to say, so what? They had plenty, ample, overwhelming evidence without it, is her argument. Do you want to respond to it now?
Sure. And again, I point out that the most important part is that's not the proper analysis. That it's not whether or not there's overwhelming evidence on the other factors. It's whether or not this piece of evidence contributed. And for this court to conclude that it didn't contribute to the jury's verdict, it would essentially have to conclude that all 12 of those jurors simply ignored the prosecution when they urged him and repeatedly said, what does Prim's confession do? It corroborates everything. It corroborates these accomplices. And so that's not the proper analysis. One second, with regard to it simply being cumulative, what court has to keep in mind, and although there's certainly a fair amount of evidence against Mr. Hagos, the lion's share of this evidence is coming from none other than Kosol So and Matt Connor, both of whom had been granted a deal that allowed them to escape the death penalty. Shrey Money got a deal. All of these guys got deals. Wayne Roberts got a deal. Yancey got a deal. These were deals that avoided class one felony convictions.
True. What about the phone records? I think she's going to mention that they had 40 some odd calls between your client and So.
Well, certainly that was a powerful piece of evidence. There's no denying that. But there certainly was no evidence as to the content of those phone calls apart from the accomplices. There was a lot of evidence that showed that Jimmy Roberts was involved in drug dealing, not only perhaps with Mr. Hagos, but also with both Matt Connor and the TRG gang members. So there are alternative explanations for those phone records. Of course, at this point, it'd be purely speculative. But again, that is a powerful piece of evidence. I won't deny that. I'd like to turn very quickly to the disqualification of the public defender, because this is, I think, perhaps the most critical issue in this case. And it's very complex. And that's why I wanted to start with the other one, which, frankly, I think is a little less complex. With regard to the disqualification of the public defender, I do not think that I can lay it out any more clearly than I have in the briefs. I would like to address the court's questions on that. I think what really happened here is that the trial judge employed an erroneous legal analysis, which, as we know, is an abuse of discretion if his ruling's based that way. And really the fundamental error that the judge made was in reaching the conclusion that the state could call Mr. Freire as a witness. The state could not have called Mr. Freire as a witness. It's conceivable that the defendant could have called Mr. Freire as a witness, but he wasn't seeking to. He hadn't endorsed Mr. Freire. And in that regard, it's very different than the attorney, the advocate witness cases such as Fognani and the recent case of Pasilla Sanchez, where it was the defendant who was trying to call his own witness, and where it was the testimony pertained to a very central, the very central issue in this case. This was a collateral witness on a collateral issue, and this was, in fact, an attempt by the prosecution that turned out to be successful to manufacture a conflict and get rid of the public defender so that it could have more time to build this case. And the courts, not just Colorado's courts, but the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly implored trial courts to be very wary of this and to view this with skepticism. And where the judge's analysis goes wrong is where he concludes that the state could have called Frary as a witness.
Well, let's assume that he was wrong for purposes of discussion. Wouldn't the defendant have wanted to call Frary as a witness if indeed the jailhouse snitch, as you called him, did testify and then he was impeached by his wife?
Well,
And assuming the wife said, Frary threatened me.
Okay. Well, he may have, but what the record is that, first of all, the record is clear that the public defenders adamantly deny that that ever occurred as officers of the court. The only evidence that this occurred was from that witness. The public defenders also were adamant that they had independent evidence that would rebut that. And so, assuming
why would it be a problem for the public defender to simply say, we will not call the wife?
Virtually the only evidence that, not the only evidence, that at that point in the prosecution had Matt Connor and a snitch. That's it. And so discrediting the snitch, and I don't mean too much disrespect by that, but that's what we are talking about. It was essential to discredit the snitch if that was going to be the evidence. And that way, Ms. Newton was an essential witness. Now, what the court should have done, and this is another way that the court went wrong, is the judge should have framed the waiver issue as, Mr. Hagos, you can call Mr. Frary as a witness, or you can keep him as a counsel of choice, but you can't do both. The choice was between Mr. Frary as an advocate or as a witness, not between Mr. Frary as an advocate or Ms. Newton as a witness. And if I could, I'd like to reserve my time. Am I correct that this 4 minutes is on the 20 or is that on the 15?
It's on the 20.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Elizabeth Rohrbaugh and I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this case. In this case, the defendant, Abraham Hagos, was convicted of first-degree murder after deliberation, attempted first-degree murder, conspiracy to commit first-degree murder, and two counts of witness retaliation. There are a couple of important things to keep in mind in the background of this case. The first is certainly that the defendant killed Roberts to silence him so that he could not be a witness in the Jefferson County drug case against him. And that's a fact that colors a lot of the evidentiary issues in this case. The other important thing to remember in this case is that this trial occurred in 2002. So with regard to the alleged trial errors, a lot of what we now might consider error would not have been considered error in 2002. It's merely a change in our understanding of the law that has changed the way we now look at how the evidence was presented at trial, but everyone presented it in good faith at the time that it happened. I'm going to talk about the issues that Mr. Rappucci has spoken about today, but I certainly welcome questions from this panel on any of the many issues that have been raised. First today, counsel has talked about the statements of Prim. Prim was the shooter in this case, but if we look at how the case put together, interestingly enough, in a first-degree murder case, he had a sort of bit part in this production because the defendant hired Cosell So to kill the victim for $20,000 ultimately. And the defendant used the information from a mutual friend, Matthew Connor, in order to locate the victim's whereabouts on the dates in question, November 4th and November 7th. So both of those men testified for the prosecution at trial, and they formed the sort of core of the story of the murder of Roberts. And the fact that these conversations, particularly telephone conversations, had taken place was in fact corroborated by the phone records showing that the conversations had taken place in the particular time frames. So we have a situation where the defendant hires Kosal So. Kosal So then looks for an underling in the TRG gang to do the actual shooting. As it turned out, Cole wound up providing the weapons in the case and also driving the shooters to and from each scene. So it is not incorrect. It is incorrect to say that he wasn't at the scene. What he wasn't there was at the scene at the exact moment of the shooting in both situations. The gunshots at both scenes were also corroborated by ballistic evidence. There were two guns that were involved in the first scene, and the one that Prim ultimately said that he fired and that So said that Prim fired was one that had been owned by So and borrowed by another gang member in a previous shooting. So the gun was really well connected to Mr. So. The second weapon is the one that was used by the Laotian man called Lay at the first scene. He was unsuccessful in getting the gun to fire, apparently had the safety on the gun. So discovered afterwards the gun did in fact work. He didn't have any more bullets for the first gun because the entire gun had been emptied in the incident, but he still had bullets for the second gun, and that was the gun that was used in the successful killing. So we have this sort of ballistic evidence that corroborates So's account of what happened. Under these circumstances, then, the role of the shooter, and in fact the shooter's identity, is a relatively minor part of this case. So in that regard, I would say, as Judge Rothenberg has said, my attitude would be, so what? The prosecution felt at the time that they could lawfully present statements of the shooter without running afoul of the Confrontation Clause based on our understanding of the Confrontation Clause at the time. Now, in 2004, of course, the Crawford case came out from the United States Supreme Court, forever changing our understanding of the Confrontation Clause. So we're looking at this in retrospect and looking at the statements that were admitted of Prim. And it's important to remember, I think, that the prosecution wanted to admit Prim's entire videotape confession, which included the fact that, for example, he was in the parking lot when the defendant paid off So after Robert's murder. But the trial court very carefully limited Prim's statements to his statements acknowledging his own role in the case. They did not implicate Hagos. They merely said that he shot on both occasions. So I think it's important to remember that what they did was they identified his role as the shooter, which was, all things considered, not an important fact in this case. And they also
It was an important fact, but it was corroborated by a lot of other testimonies, what you're saying.
Yes, it was corroborated by a lot of other testimony, and I think also that the defense position was that, in fact, the murder had been perpetrated by the Cambodian gang members. The defense position was that the gang members had done this apparently for reasons of their own, and the defendant was not involved. If you look at the closing arguments of defense counsel, there is not an argument that So and the other TRG members, including Prim, were not involved. It was merely an argument that the defendant was not the engineer behind the killing.
You mean Prim was not the engineer, or defendant was?
The defense argument was that the defendant was not the engineer behind the killing. And as I said, it was accepted that Prim was the killer. But on the other hand, Prim's identity as the killer was, in the end, just sort of a small detail. I mean, there had been Asian men seen at the first scene. They were the suspicious guys hanging around the bus stop that Roberts and his brother had confronted immediately before the killing. recognizing them as potential gang members sent by the defendant.
Mr. Rappucci, your opponent has referred to at least 15 sites in the opening and closing statements of the prosecutor. I know you were not there, but you read it. And where they referred to Kim, to Prim, rather, kept saying, Prim this, Prim that, that's the connection, connecting the dots.
Your Honor, I guess I would like to make a distinction between Prim,
okay,
because So identified Prim as the gunman.
Right.
And in fact, one of the things that Mr. Rappucci has cited in the brief is the prosecutor urging the jury to take away with them the image of Prim emptying the clip into Roberts' car that killed Roberts. But that is not dependent on Prim's confession, the statement of Prim that Prim was at the scene. We have the testimony of So that he had taken Prim to the scene and taken Prim away from the scene.
Okay,
we have
could you have made the case without Prim's statement?
Certainly without those particular statements of Prim.
Tell us, you say the case is overwhelming. Briefly.
Yes.
And would you just rat-a-tat-tat the evidence that would have shown, in a nutshell, without Prim, that would have gotten this guy overwhelmingly convicted? By this guy, I mean the defendant.
Right, and Your Honor, it's just, again, I want to make a distinction between what other people said about Prim and what, in fact, Prim said about himself. And the very, very limited statements that Prim made that were custodial statements that the detective testified to. Because I think that's an important distinction, that I think that absolutely Prim's custodial statements were cumulative of his non-custodial statements. So I don't want to make an argument that excludes Prim entirely, but only Prim's custodial statements, which were that he was at the scene both nights. And of course, he made those statements in non-custodial settings to fellow gang members. So the fact that he was there that night, we don't need the officer's testimony about what he had said in custody to have Prim's own statement that he was there that night. We also, of course, have So's statements that he hired Prim. We have the phone records that he called Prim. He picked Prim up. He delivered him to both scenes and drove him away from both scenes. So Prim definitely had a role, but that role is contingent on Cosell's So's being hired by the defendant.
Okay. Another thing your opponent's saying is we can't consider whether evidence was overwhelming. Do you agree with that?
No, Your Honor, I don't. And I left my brief on counsel desk. Can I pick it up for a second?
Certainly.
Thank you.
I haven't turned to this page where I've set out the test from Blecka versus People, which is page 53 of my brief. And so factors to be considered under Blecka, which I think we can agree is the test for harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, is whether the testimony was cumulative, the presence or absence of corroborating or contradictory evidence and the material points of the witness's testimony, the extent of cross-examination otherwise permitted, and the overall strength of the prosecution's case. So I think that the overall strength of the prosecution's case is, in fact, something that this court can consider in finding the admission of these, as I said, very few statements made in custody to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because of all the other evidence of Prim's involvement, including the non-custodial statements. I will turn now to issue number two, which was the disqualification of the public defender, seeing that I have about half of my time left. I would like to begin by saying that I do dispute counsel's argument in the briefs that this would be structural error requiring automatic reversal of the defendant's case. And I cited in supplemental authority that I hope this court has had a chance to look at a Fourth Circuit case, which I think lays out reasoning very well of why this is so, the case of United States versus Basham. And in this way, certainly it's not that indigent defendants don't have an interest in their counsel and don't have counsel of choice concerns. It's merely that they don't have the opportunity to have whatever counsel they like. As indigent defendants, they are entitled to competent counsel at state expense. And I cited this particular case because it's a similar situation where counsel was replaced by very, very competent counsel in a situation far enough advanced from trial that there was not a hardship, and thus there was no prejudice to the defendant. And if we're not looking in a structural error context, then we do look at whether there was prejudice, and there simply was no prejudice with the replacement of Fernando Freire and the Public Defender's Office with Chambers and Lewis, who are both very, very good lawyers. When we look at the facts of this case, it's a peculiar string of evidence that we are looking at. I think that the court is aware of this mostly, but started off that apparently in the grand jury proceedings, an important part of the people's case were inculpatory statements made by the defendant to this man named Robert Newton. So for this reason, Freire and the Public Defender's Office were appointed after the grand jury had found probable cause. They were obviously interested in discrediting Mr. Newton, and for that reason went to talk with Mrs. Newton. And our record indicates that there were a couple of different jail visits, but what was important was on the second of the jail visits, Freire not only came and spoke to the witness by himself, thus not having an investigator present who could be a witness as to what had gone on. There was apparently, either accidentally or on purpose, a face-to-face encounter between the witness, Patricia Newton, and the defendant. So Newton, Patricia Newton, later contacted the prosecution to report that she felt she had been threatened by the public defender, and that she was especially scared by the fact that she felt that he had brought her face-to-face with the defendant, which scared her very much in a witness-killing case. So these allegations came forward, and a number of hearings were had at which Patricia Newton was a witness. And clearly, the trial court found that there was this meeting between Freire and Patricia Newton. It lasted about an hour. She alleged that a number of statements had been made to her by Freire, including that leaving her family out of it was not an option, that if she were to testify for the defendant, she would put herself on the safe side of the line. If she were to testify, the defendant would want her to know he would not hurt her or her family. And if she thought the defendant was dangerous, she would be helping herself out to help him out. So the trial court found that these had occurred. As a matter of fact, this was supported by Patricia Newton's testimony. So we get then to the question of Rule 3.7, which is that a lawyer shall not act as an advocate at trial in which the lawyer is likely to make a necessary witness. And under the circumstances in this case, Freire wound up making himself a necessary witness.
For whom?
For either side, Your Honor.
How would he be a witness for the prosecution? Under what circumstances would the prosecution want to call him for any reason?
Your Honor, we may have a tactical question of who might wish to call him based on whom he might present favorable testimony for. But that doesn't preclude either side from calling him as a witness.
Well, the prosecution would have to show a compelling need for his testimony.
Well, the prosecution might need to call him with regard to inconsistencies in statements by Patricia Newton, which could be proved up by extrinsic evidence, which could be Freire's testimony.
Could be proved up by the hearing testimony, too.
Your Honor, that might be one way, but I don't know that the prosecution would necessarily be precluded. On the other hand, the defendant also had a serious interest, if Newton testified, in calling Freire as a witness.
Well,
so I'm not sure.
Might. I'm just not sure how the prosecution might be able to show a compelling need, because they'd have to show adversity, they'd have to show admissibility, and a compelling need for all three, would they not?
Your Honor, I think Are you, on what basis are you saying that?
Based on the Williams case.
But the Williams case involved the prior set of rules of professional conduct.
Do you think it's different based upon the new rules?
Well, I think it may be, because the Williams case does say that the witness's testimony has to be adverse, but Rule 3.7 doesn't require adversity. And if we look at the recent cases, which were cited by counsel in the reply brief, those recent cases were Casillas-Sanchez and also the Mestes case. Both of those were instances in which the lawyer was the defense lawyer who was going to testify for the defendant. So I'm not sure that adversity is necessarily required under the rules as they are presently constituted. And I think both of those cases are valuable guidance for this court, because in the Mestes case, Mr. Mestes wanted, and this was, in fact, retained counsel, Harvey Steinberg, to remain as his lawyer. Steinberg had been subpoenaed as a witness in a related case, and the error that the Supreme Court found in that case was that the client was not permitted to waive that conflict. And that's not true in this case. There was the option for the defendant to waive the conflict, but it was the defense lawyer who was going to be a witness in that case. Similarly, if we look at the Casillas case, in that case, Mr. Casillas actually wanted his lawyer, Mr. Lozo, to testify on his behalf. And the court said, if he's going to testify on his client's behalf, then he can't also be an advocate in the case. So I think that it's clear that defense lawyer testifying for the defendant is also a part of the picture, and not only if the prosecution can call the witness at trial. And the defense had two ways out of this. The first was that the defense could remain on the case but not call Newton. And of course, in hindsight, we can say Newton was collateral, as Mr. Rapucci has described her today. In hindsight, she does look collateral. But at the time, she was considered a very important witness. And but her testimony was entirely optional on the part of the defense, whether they wanted to call her to as a character witness to testify as to her husband's testimony. So it was in the defense control about whether to call her as a witness. The defendant was then given a choice as to whether he wanted to continue with the public defender, knowing that the witness could not be called, or whether he did not want to waive this conflict. And I'd like to point out that at every point in all of the conflict of counsel issues in this case, the defendant got what he wanted. He chose not to waive this conflict, and he got new counsel. Then after he got new counsel, he said repeatedly in the face of either potential or ethical conflicts that he wanted to remain with counsel. My time is now expired. I thank this court for its careful consideration of this case. I'd ask you to affirm the defense convictions.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The fact of the matter is that Williams is good law, and this court has identified the proper factors: actual adversity, admissibility, and compelling need. Not a single one of those factors was here, so the state could not have called Frary. Whether the defense may have wanted to call him, you know, my esteemed colleague has said Ms. Newton was a very important witness. She was a very important witness. That's why it was an impermissible choice to make Mr. Haggos choose between her and his choice of counsel. And Mr. Haggos did not get what he wanted. He was very clear that he wanted to continue with his counsel of choice. And Colorado, we're not talking about effective assistance of counsel here. We're talking about choice of counsel. And Colorado law is very, very clear. I almost don't have to remind this court of the cases, but there's Harlan, there is Martinez, there is the new case of Mestes, there's Cherie. There's a long line of cases that say that this choice of counsel is entitled to great weight you know, getting rid of this is last resort. Here, it wasn't last resort. And my briefs lay that out very clearly. There was three different ways to get rid of this without forcing Mr. Hagos to give up that which he wanted, which was his counsel of choice. And those were, the judge could have precluded the entire incident pursuant to 403. The judge could have precluded the entire incident, any evidence of it, pursuant to the Martinez case, the Martinez remedy. Even if the court didn't abuse its discretion in not choosing either of those alternatives, either one of which would have made it not last resort, it did abuse its discretion when, instead of putting the deliberate choice to Mr. Hagos to choose between Mr. Freire as his attorney and Mr. Freire as a witness, he instead put it between, he made the choice between two constitutional rights, calling a material witness for a complete defense and keeping your counsel of choice. And that violates substantive due process. The Bergerud case tells us that. Campbell tells us that. There's any number of cases that tell us that are all cited in my brief. And I think one of the most important points from Bergerud, which the Supreme Court has granted certiorari in that case, but I don't believe it's really on the exact issue in that case that I'm referencing. You cannot have a valid waiver from an impermissible choice. And that's what was given to Mr. Hagos here, an impermissible choice. Therefore, the waiver that he did make, which was essentially, you know, it wasn't a waiver, frankly, because it wasn't voluntary, knowing, and intelligent, certainly wasn't voluntary. It wasn't a valid waiver. What he ended up forfeiting was his right to counsel of choice. This choice should never have been put to him. You know, and going back to Williams, the Pasilla-Sanchez case, you know, I believe that case cites Williams. There's no, the rule did change, the ethical rule did change, but the reasoning did not. And for the prosecution to simply be able to call a defendant's attorney would still do exactly what it did during the Williams case, which is render the entire defense bar subservient to the state. And that's intolerable. And there's just simply no way to write off Williams, the Williams case. It is good law, it's well-reasoned, and it makes perfect sense. Going back, and so, you know, frankly, I do think this is the most important issue in this case. And it is a structural error, and whether or not this court wants to call it a structural error or simply an abuse of discretion resulting in reversal, the fact of the matter is, you can't do an analysis of prejudice, and it's not the proper inquiry. We're not talking about the effectiveness of counsel. We're talking about choice of counsel and the inviolability of that when an indigent defendant is appointed an attorney and decides to keep him. It's no less inviolable than the Sixth Amendment. And any attempt to apply a harmless error analysis would be a speculative analysis in an alternate universe. It just can't be done. And reversal is required. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can set up and be prepared.